Good afternoon, everyone. This is Robin Ayoub from the Localization Fireside Chat, and welcome to another episode. Today, we are recording another episode of Localization Fireside Chat. It's been a while. Happy New Year to all. Happy New Year to everybody. I hope 2025 brings you a lot of happiness, prosperity, health, anything that you put your mind to. I hope you achieve it in 2025. To all of our audience, welcome back. I took a few weeks off during the holidays from recording, and now back to recording and editing videos on the weekends. So I want to thank our guest who's joining me today. I have the honor to have with me Cynthia Kanowitz and Bruno Herrmann. Bruno, you're a face that everybody remembers on this channel. Thanks for coming back. Cynthia, thank you for joining me. That's your first episode with me. Hopefully, it's not the last one. Hopefully, we'll get you back again. Hopefully, you enjoy the event today, the conversation today. It was great meeting you both in outside of the country in Saudi Arabia a few weeks ago in November. I got to know Cynthia, and first time meeting Bruno face-to-face. We had a chance to spend some time together, and I really enjoyed our conversation. Our flights together were great as well. We had a chance to sit and at the lounge and enjoy a meal together before we take off to Germany. Great to see you both. I will start the conversation, I guess, for the audience, for those who don't know you. Why don't we start with Cynthia? If you don't mind, Cynthia, just give us a little bit of an introduction for yourself. That'd be great.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure being with both of you. And it was great meeting you. Thank you for having me at your YouTube. It's such a nice channel. So yeah, I'm Cynthia Kanowitz. I'm currently, I would say, kind of like a program manager at Bold. This company, we sell resumes and cover letters. I manage the end-to-end localization and our strategy overall. And yeah, it's a pleasure being here with the two of you. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you, Cynthia. Bruno?
Yes, so my name is Bruno Herrmann. I still have 30 years of experience in the globalization field. I started my career in the 90s, which doesn't make me very young, but anyway. And I started on the supplier side, so in localization agencies. And then I moved to the client side of the globalization field. So I worked for several multinationals where I was building teams and ecosystems to manage multilingual content and products. And a couple of years ago, I restarted my consultancy to help organizations, specifically in life sciences, technology, and market research industries, you know, implement global content supply chains, global product supply chains. And of course, now there is a lot of work with the implementation with AI, but we will for sure talk about that a bit later on.
Yeah, absolutely. And good to see you both again. For those who are listening to the conversation today, and thanks for joining us, I wanted to take the conversation today and give the audience the perspective of the client, the perspective of the localization manager, if you will, the perspective of how does companies such Bold, for instance, and for those of you who are not familiar with Bold, Bold is such a great organization. They're specialized in resume and cover writing, cover letter writing. And they do it in many languages. And Cynthia, you know, she's very humble. She's very modest. She did not mention it, but I'll mention it because I've got her bio right in front of me. She localized 30 websites. She's used freelancers. She's continuously using freelancers right now. She's using suppliers on the outside of her organization today. She's leading the charge, actually, in transforming her business the way that Bruno, myself, and many other localization, I want to say, influencers in our space have been advocating and talking about. Again, for Cynthia, let's start with you. You know, we hear a lot of conversation about, you know, new technology and AI starting to sound like really cliche at this point. Tell me, like, in the fog of all this, in the midst of all this, how is this affecting your business? Any impact?
I feel like the same impact we're feeling on everything on our daily lives is the same impact that we feel in our business, right? I feel like those changes, all these technological changes that are happening are the same that are happening throughout society. And as a sociologist, I would say it's happening everywhere all the time, right? It's not specifically in our industry, especially when we enter this conversation regarding AI and people thinking it's coming for my job, etc. I disagree with this view. I think that AI, it's such a helpful tool. It shouldn't be seen as a threat, but as a means of reaching better quality, making things faster, and actually differentiating yourself. Right now, it's all about learning those new things, those new methodologies, and differentiating yourself. So I don't think it's impacting us as much. Of course, on the client side, I imagine every company, every project manager, product program manager out there is probably getting those questions right from executive leadership asking, is it possible to make things cheaper and faster? But I think at the end of the day, the aspect of getting things done, it's just here to help us make things faster. Not necessarily, it's not taking anyone's job. It's just increasing productivity and actually opening more markets, because by doing things slightly faster, we can do more.
Absolutely. Now, Bruno, I know on the client side, you've spent, you know, close to 15 years almost with Nielsen. Tell me, you know, it hasn't been that long since you've left. So how, you know, I mean, I'm talking about not decades, we're talking about a few years since your last job with Nielsen. So tell me, how does what you've had with Nielsen compare to what Cynthia is experiencing today and what you've experienced today with your client deploying the new methodology and technology in place?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I would, first of all, I would agree with Cynthia that the impact for me is called change. That's the key word, because, well, you can call it transformation, evolution. But for me, change is really the core of what we are in the middle of right now. So that's the first point. And going back to my own experience, I have to say that I was pretty lucky, because Nielsen was a business intelligence company, well, still is a business intelligence company, and I was able to face some challenges that are now very critical with AI. The first one was data management, how to manage language data, not for AI, but for BI, just one letter of difference, but intelligence was already there. And also, you know, how to create an ecosystem where data could accelerate, could enhance, could sometimes even replace existing business processes. And I think that that's what I see right now. After my long experience with Nielsen, and then I also worked several years in another BI company called IQVIA, which is in the life science company. In these companies, I was really lucky. I didn't know I was lucky, but now I can say that I was lucky that I was really exposed to a number of activities. I mentioned data management, but I could mention also the globalization processes and also, as I said, technology ecosystems that were very complex. So these were very complex companies, but I enjoyed that. And I still enjoy it now as a consultant, because I realized that a number of organizations are, you know, considering the change that we are living as something complex. Sometimes they are right, sometimes they are wrong. Sometimes they are right because, for instance, in the life science industry where I spend a lot of time, it's a regulated industry. And as a regulated industry, there are a number of dependencies, obligations, requirements that you have to meet. So it adds a layer of complexity just because of compliance, if you know what I mean. Then, of course, in other industries which are non-regulated, maybe, you know, it's not about compliance and not about regulation, but it's about making sure that the dots are connected. Mm. And I think that's the image that I like to keep in my mind every time I'm, you know, starting a new program with a client, or if I'm just asked like now to give my opinion about the change we are living. It's about connecting the dots. And the dots are three groups of dots, actually. The people, Cynthia mentioned, of course, that we are all humans, so we are living in human environments, in human organizations. The second groups of dots, the second business processes, we all have to manage business processes. These processes might be called translation, localization, testing, UX. Well, you know, there is a bunch of processes that we have to manage. And then the last group of dots is tools and systems. And each group of these dots are changing now. New skill sets for the people, new tool sets for the ecosystems, and new processes for the business processes. So that's the picture. It's really connecting the dots in a way which is different.
You know, from my perspective, I think you guys would agree with me, is that a few years ago, we were focused on getting the job done. That's to put it in very basic and simple terms. You know, you get a project, you're worried about delivery, you're worrying about finding freelancer to meet your timeline or the skills that you're looking for, language combinations, subject knowledge, those types of things. I think today the problem has pretty much gone away. And now we're looking for coordinators. We're looking for people who knows the language, know the what needs to be done from a language quality perspective, and how can we embed these individuals into our, back to your point, Bruno, into the process. So back to the process for a second, Cynthia. I know, like, on, you know, from a client perspective, from your perspective, I'm sure you've seen things changed in the past 2-3 years. What are the major things, or you can point to one or two big projects that you've undertaken that you think those are major changes?
I would say the place that localization is joining the conversation, that's a huge shift I have seen. And I have been advocating for that a lot, for us to be involved on more things.
So you mean we moved from being an afterthought, right?
Exactly, yes. and I feel like this is, it's nothing new, right? It's something that has been happening, has been there for decades. But I feel like now, more than ever, it's a moment of localization, finding its place, being part, coming up front, getting involved in a strategy. We see all these changes in big companies, big techs, right? Silicon Valley, downsizing their localization teams. So this is the moment to show value. It's the moment to show how effective our localization strategy can be, how much value we can bring to the company. And yeah, it's all about bringing value and being effective. And the way we're also measuring things within localization has changed a lot. We're not just stuck on checking some numbers and framework. It's a much more complicated way of rating satisfaction of our user, right? We need to be much more involved in product development than just, okay, those are the localization metrics. We did this many thousand words, million words, and that's it. No, we need to show how much value have we delivered. How are we involved in conversion rate increasing? So that's the biggest shift I have been seeing.
Yeah, that's right. Now, there is a theory out there, help me, if I'd like to get your perspective on, is that in today's age, people are not necessarily spending less on translation or localization. They're pretty much spending equal or maybe a little more, but they're translating a hell of a lot more. They're able to push a lot more content. They wanted to translate before, maybe because of cost constraint or complexities or capacity that we're not able to do before. What's your perspective? Have you seen on your side that the demand will go down or budget stayed flat? Like, what's your perspective on that?
The field has been pretty equal and growing exponentially, the number of requests, the amount of things that we need to be involved. And also, we also need to demand in the same way and make sure, okay, if we're increasing the number of projects by 3 times, we need to also increase budget. We need to request another position for another project manager to support this specific project. So in my case, things have only been growing.
It's been growing. Thanks for clarification. Now, Bruno, Cynthia mentioned something very interesting, which is, you know, conversion rate on the translation outcome or on the translation projects, right? Not necessarily measuring things, but is that a good quality or not good quality? Do we follow terminology? Did we not follow terminology? I think this is a given now, right? So you've got a terminology, you've got a TMS, you know, technology is allowing you to follow it without any human errors in this case, because technology is building this. What's your thoughts on outcome-based performance? And have you done any projects in that regard? What do you think of that? And if you can give us some ideas on how to do that.
Yeah, that's a great point. Actually, I was going to say that right now, as a consultant, I'm just acting in the same way as when I was a permanent employee on the client side. In other words, I'm walking in the shoes of a client, even if I'm a consultant. And indeed, most, if not all, actually, I have to think, probably all clients, I don't have 100 clients, but all clients working with me for the moment or working with me last year, they have a perspective on multilingual content and multilingual products, which unfortunately is not very well understood by some suppliers, not all suppliers, but some suppliers. Suppliers are seeing the production, the productivity of the amount of translated content, the amount of words, the million of words. And so it's a very productivity-oriented picture that they have because they have to deliver that to the client, and the client is going to create the value with this delivery subsequently. But the client, on the client side, people and specifically decision makers are looking at projects regarding, you know, projects involving multilingual content, localization, translation, or products, multilingual products, as a part, an important part, but as a part of something bigger, which is called global content operations, global content supply chains, global product supply chains. My view has never been very popular about that, because I remember in 2008, I made my first presentation, and it was called Elevate, Integrate, Celebrate. And the message to the localization industry was, if you want to create more value, make sure that you or the people on the client side are elevated so that they don't remain as the commodity level. Because otherwise, of course, the discussion, the outcome will be just very commodity oriented. So not very value driven, but more community oriented. So that's the elevation. Then integration. Integration in global content supply chains. And this is where some people are reluctant, because they believe that localization or globalization should stay apart. It should be a different entity in the business, but, you know, a little bit disconnected from the other players in the supply chain. And these players are the content designers, the content developers, the UX people, etc. So that's the integration. So once people, localization, globalization teams are integrated, and sometimes even suppliers can do that, are integrated in the supply chain or the content operations of the client, then they can be celebrated. Because the value of what they do, the outcome of the project, we no longer be the millions of words or, you know, the number of languages or the number of markets. It will be what has been the real impact on the bottom line and what has been the real impact on the customer experience. Let's be clear. That's where, of course, it becomes, as an outcome, it becomes something very different than, you know, something which is just production oriented. We call it, I remember this term about metrics, vanity metrics. The vanity metrics are, in my teams, when I was leading teams, we had vanity metrics. We could say we were localizing for 35 markets and we translated, you know, 15 million words last month. But that was never impressing anyone in the organization, because the people were saying, oh, great, so what? And the so what is exactly what is missing in the outcome. And that's why I've always been preaching. Although, you know, I'm working right now with a couple of brave LSPs that are accepting my view, but believe it or not, it has never been very popular on the supplier side, just because there is this misunderstanding, sometimes this misconception of how clients are actually considering translation, localization, globalization. It's considered as an element, whereas for some suppliers, it's the whole thing. So, you know, we have to be realistic. That's my point. For outcome, you know, for outcome-driven projects, it has to be more than just vanity, and it has to be realistic enough to be understood as one part of global content operation.
You know, you bring up a very good point, because you're bringing now localization and translation in general closer to the business decisions. Mm-hmm. You know, back in the days, even now, there are some companies where translation on the client side, you know, that they are not close to the business decisions. They're an afterthought in the business, right? So, you know, it's just like, and I hate to say this, and it shouldn't be the case. And if anybody's listening to this message, let me change it. I hope they change their approach to this. Is localization, it is not equal to your mailing services. It's not equal to your, you know, any other adjunct services that you have in your business, that it's necessarily evil, as they say, right? So it's more than that, because it's your written word, it's your image, it's your who you are as a business. Now, when we talk about outcome, and I'm addressing Cynthia in this question, talk about outcome in the localization or in the translation. A lot of outcome is based on business outcome, meaning that, you know, did I convert more visitors to your website? Did I generate more sales by translating it correctly, translating project correctly, etc.? Is this your understanding? Is this how you're measuring things in your world, or you have not gotten to that level yet?
I agree that mine sounds like it's very business oriented, but if you look into it, we're all connected, right? We're all trying to deliver. We have the same goal. As a company, we're all trying to make sure we deliver a quality product that satisfies our client, our user. So in the end of the day, those metrics that are often seen as something outside of localization, those metrics belong to us as well. We're part of this ecosystem, as Bruno mentioned. We're doing this together. We have the same goals in mind. So I don't differentiate those goals and those KPIs at all from product and localization. I think we're united on those.
That's right. But have you done any real metrics, though, for things like conversion on your website or increase of sale? Have you done any metrics? Do you have any examples? No?
We have been asking for more and more data with time. One of the things we did this past December is put together all the conversion rates of all the sites we localized overall since we started doing this and making sure we keep track of all of those numbers and keeping like metrics that we can keep for future use in the sense of, okay, this is the existing conversion rate today. And today you were asking me to work on this full audit for your website. So I'm going to take a screenshot today and take a screenshot in 6 months from now and have those numbers. Because then it's a clear way of proving how localization is involved on improving those numbers.
That's the return on investment that everybody's looking for, right? So what is the ROI on translation, correct? Now, from Cynthia, while I got you, like, on the mic here, think about, if you don't mind, one of your best supplier that you're working with. What are the two or three characteristics that you like about them?
Okay, right now we have most of our things in-house. One of the few things we still outsource that we're still using vendors is when it comes to like recording some sort of services, for example, phone services, IVRs for our phone department. And that's one of the things that we need the most because we don't have a studio. You need to have the specific voice. They have a bigger pool. So those were one of the reasons why we would go to a company. But of course, there's also, we need to keep in mind pricing, etc. So we're always reevaluating those details to make this decision. So usually, just to summarize, are the things that are harder for us to keep upkeep in-house.
And so if you were to say, you know, I'm dealing with company A and I like one, two, three things about that company, what would that be the attraction? Mm-hmm. Is it fast? They're fast, they're convenient. Price, cheap. I don't know. I don't want to put words in your mouth. I'm trying.
I would say convenient. It's easy to send this than having to deal with all the setups of making sure the audio is going to be delivered perfectly. There's no background noise.
You're specifically talking about interpretation, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Phone services and this type of recording. Because since we have all of those freelancers, it would be complicated to ensure the same level of quality. So it's just easier to send to an expert to do that part.
Absolutely. Hey, Bruno, on your side, like and I know you deal with a few LSPs out there. Has anything changed? I know some of them are trying, but do you see any dramatic change in the way they're going to the market, in the way they're offering their services, in the way they're speaking about our services?
Yes, for some of them, not all of them. And that's probably the main challenge in the localization industry or the language industry right now is that a number of suppliers haven't made the move yet. But talking about those who have, you know, changed the way they address the market, the way they want to keep creating value with their clients, because at the end of the day, that's the end of the game. Yes, in the past, when I say that, you know, until maybe even 18 months ago, many language services suppliers, and I'm talking here about services, not technology, but many LSPs, as we call them, were clearly positioning themselves as offering translation, localization, transcreation, terminology management, etc. With AI, specifically with generative AI, they saw that the age of traditional language services was over. It was now more about to create value with language in a more extended way with what we'd call, what I call, and I know it's terminology that is becoming now more mainstream, content and data services. So why content services? Because language is much more than just translation, localization, or even, you know, globalization. Language is everywhere. When you think about one piece of content or one product, language is there from day one. Because the way you design, the way you create your content, even if it's just one language, it's in English, language is there. It has to be right from day one, from the outset. There is no way to say, oh, we'll see if English is fine at the end. No, it has to be done.
Even in the architecture of the product.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why, you know, I keep preaching for, a better collaboration between clients and suppliers, specifically product and content teams on the client side, and project managers and linguists on supplier side, because if they understand each other, they will finally say that language is much more than what they are doing today. And when I say content services, I will give you just one example, but a very fucking use that term, because I see it a bit everywhere now. Finally, it's becoming more reality. It is the conversion of, first of all, the management, and then the conversion of assets being the files, so PowerPoint, PDF, Word, etc. The conversion of these assets into data to train the language models. When I say it in 1 second, it sounds easy, but it's quite complex. You have to do that right. And there are so many companies, Amazon. Well, I mentioned Amazon because they wrote a great article last year about what they were doing with language data. And they were saying that essentially they were converting millions, I say millions, of video, audio, and text files into data to train the language model that they were going to use in their AI for customer service. And of course, that's right. That's the way to do it. You take all the feedback, all the customer conversations, and then you create the data that you can feed into your agent, since we talk about agents all the time now. Mm-hmm. So I think that this is the traditional language services age is over, and that's what many clients know already. Mm-hmm. But there are not enough suppliers who know or accept that. Mm-hmm. And as a result, they keep offering traditional language services, which are no longer relevant or no longer value-driven for clients, because clients are already in another age, which is content and data services. And if I had to create an LSP today myself, which I won't do, don't worry, but if I had to set up my own company as an LSP, first of all, I would not call it an LSP. I would call it probably a language business partner or something like that. But I would say that my offering, my value proposition would be to my clients, how can I help you manage your multilingual assets, data, models, effectively, cost and time effectively. And that means, of course, that I would use my expertise in language management, but mm-hmm. I would do more than that. I would do much more than just offering translation localization. As I said, I would help my clients create and manage language data, even create prompts. In prompts, the language is critical. If the language is not well used in prompts, the output is just rubbish. So you see, that's the very, I love this evolution, but I know on the supplier side, not everybody does that.
And to take another point to what you were just saying, which is absolutely true, is resistance to change in those LSPs and in hope. There's a hope and prayer there, right? So things are, they're hoping in their mind that I have enough market segment attached to that particular services that I'm offering that will stay around, that will not move, that will always be there. I hope they do. I mean, I don't want anybody to be unhappy. But at the same time, the world is completely changing. And, what we're talking about, I was just having a conversation several weeks ago about this topic. You know, this whole AGI that we're in right now, and AGI still in its first phase, in a year or two from now, or maybe more, maybe less, God knows, but things are moving fast. And we're going to get into ASI, the artificial super intelligence, they're calling it right now, where you've got, it's faster, make better decisions than human. Today, you're asking AGI what to do and telling it what to do and how to do it. ASI supposedly will tell you how to do things. So it'll be the one, the student becomes the teacher. That's how it's going to be. In your world right now, Cynthia, do you use AI at all? Or how does that impact you guys? Where do you use it?
Yeah, we use some CAT tools, of course, like everyone else is doing it. But also we help other departments training prompts and reviewing to make sure it's properly adapted for that locale. So yeah, mm-hmm. we're very immersed on that.
So an AI for you, is it part of the process or sometime? Is it like fixed step in the process or what it applies?
I think it depends. It depends the type of the project, how much marketing.
You're selectively using it then.
Yes. And like, for example, let's say you have to create 10 landing pages, pretty much of the same content, but you need to be creative. Sometimes it's hard for us to come up with 10 ways of saying the same sentence. And it makes the life of the translator and the project manager so much easier to just give me some ideas here. Sometimes you're like, oh, okay, I didn't even think of that. So it makes the life of everyone easier on this process. The UX writer, the project manager, the translator. So there are so many ways that we could be using. Plus also in our services, we're also implementing that in our websites to make the life of our users easier as well. So yeah, we're using AI in multiple ways.
Is there a particular piece of content for you, Bold, that you absolutely will not send to AI?
Specific things that we wouldn't run by AI, but there are definitely certain things that 100% of the time we always need to have humans reviewing. We try to do that with pretty much everything we do, but there are certain things that require even more human revision.
And when it comes to ethical use of AI and security and all that stuff, do you have any policies around that, or you're just using the generic version?
We have like a version that was created for the company that we can use with a little bit more safety. And also there was some training from our legal department of what we can do and what we can't do. So we were involved on that.
Okay, cool. Bruno, what do you think of this whole AI and the security, data sovereignty policies around that? And also the amount of data that sometimes, and I'm talking about companies or client companies that they may have, you know, 100,000 employees out there, they're not going to be able to control all of them. Sometimes they put things on these publicly available AI platforms that probably they shouldn't be putting out there. At least that's my understanding. I'm not sure that everybody is the same, but I see a risk area there. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I agree. There is a risk. I think I see two approaches with data right now. I see companies that are really managing their data, as you said, in a way which is not totally secure, that is not totally under control, even for themselves. And of course, you know, if it's not controlled for themselves, it's obviously out of control for the rest of the world. So that is one thing which is a bit concerning. There are other companies that have clearly understood that their data lakes or their data sets are now gold. And when I say gold, I mean that they can be monetized. I can take the example of a famous social network, Reddit. Reddit signed an agreement last year with Google to actually sell the content that is exchanged, that is shared on their social media to Google, because that's their data. So it's data from Reddit going to Google so that Google could actually create language data for their models based on this data coming from Reddit. So this is an example of a company that has a lot of data and that sees an interest in monetizing the data thanks to the huge demand for data for AI training, generative AI or predictive AI. And I think that's really, these are two approaches. Of course, I prefer the second one, because if a company is paying attention to its data, it means that there is a process in place, there is a policy, there is governance. So that is a good sign, versus companies that are a little bit struggling with their data because they don't have enough experience. But they know it's necessary. They know data is key, but they don't know how to manage it. They don't know how to maintain it. They don't know how to actually, even internally, how to make sure that it's secured.
Yeah,
and I would add just one thing, because going back to my preferred life science industry, in this industry, data is even more critical, even more sensitive, because of course, there is data from patients, there is data from clinical trials, there is data from different sources that are extremely, not just sensitive, that are extremely, vulnerable, and you have to be super extra careful in the way you use this data. Sometimes you have to anonymize data. Sometimes you have to de-anonymize data.
Mm.
My point is that if you are in a regulated industry, not just life science but finance, legal, etc., the data strategy is even more of a priority than in other companies. It should be a priority in all companies today, but I would say in regulated industries, it should be even more, just because if data is not managed properly, just forget about compliance.
Yeah. And you know what? There are something called data brokers. That's why I asked the question. And data brokers are those companies who are selling data to other companies. So they own the records and they're selling data. But what has been happening, according to the publicly available news out there, these companies have been opaque about their dealing when it comes to buying and selling data. A few examples, that would be Experian, that would be one. Equifax is another one. Exium is another one. And Epsilon. Mm-hmm. So those are the four top data broker companies that they're out there, that they are selling data or making deals on data. I don't know if they're selling is the word, the appropriate word here, but making deal on data somehow because they own a lot of data. And the theory there is that there is an arm length distance between the company that owns the data record and the person that actually originated the data. So let's say you go fill out a credit application for something. You fill out the credit application for something, Equifax collects the data, and you don't talk to Equifax on a daily basis. The arm length information, now it's a repository of information in their database, and they can run and generate some other algorithms off of it. That's one. And the third one, which is, I started 3 years ago, started, but now it's gaining traction. And this is coming from and I don't know your opinion, Cynthia and Bruno, will let you both target this one. There is a theory out there that AI has consumed all available data. There is no more data to be consumed. That's the theory. And there are businesses being started right now that deals with synthetic data, meaning you would like to create data. You don't have the right data. Okay, I'll create it for you using AI to create the said data. So where are we in, I know we've been, when we went to Saudi Arabia, looping back to where we started the conversation, when we were in Saudi Arabia, there was a lot of talk about, for instance, as an example, the Arabic language and how much data exists in AI from the Arabic language combination. And the conclusion was not as much, for instance, as English and French. It's much less than that. And do we need more? Obviously, the more, the better, because then you have a better outcome from an AI perspective. But using that same logic, where do you think, can you give us a bit of an opinion, Cynthia, I'll start with you on what I just said from your perspective.
Yeah, I think synthetic data is definitely being used for some testing and figure out optimal scenarios for our users instead of dealing with real data. But I think also in this whole conversation regarding data, it's important to note that there is a difference between the field that you're working, the size of the company, etc., right? Our team of localization, we don't have access to real user data in that sense. So we have no risk on that whatsoever. And of course, there's plenty of things in place to keep the user data safe and not being put into that. But yeah, we have specific scenarios that we use synthetic data to test when we're creating specific sentences to put in our websites to run some tests that are produced. Those sentences are produced by our linguists. So we're pretty much fabricating that instead of using the things that were input by the users.
So synthetic data is being used in certain cases now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Bruno, what do you think of that?
I would agree definitely with Cynthia about the use of synthetic data for, experiments or testing, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
I see another use of synthetic data is, of course, for low-resource languages. Because low-resource languages, you mentioned Arabic, I think there are some great examples right now in India, considering, of course, the number of languages in India, but also considering that Indic languages are considered, at least most of them, are considered as low resource languages. So in that case, you can really close a gap with synthetic data because there is nothing out there that can really help you fill the gap other than synthetic data. So testing and low resource languages, yes, for synthetic data. For the theory about, there is no more, or we are close to the end of all available data, I disagree.
Okay.
I disagree. Because there is not just one, but there are dozens, hundreds of sources of data that are not tapped for the moment. And these sources are in the assets I just mentioned. Most companies, not just e-commerce, because of course I think there are many examples in e-commerce, but most companies, if not all companies, they have sometimes just a few dozens, sometimes millions of files that they created. PowerPoint, as I said, video files, audio files, recording of customer conversations, etc. All these files are not data yet, but they can become data. And that was the reason why I made the point about business opportunities to actually, as a language service supplier or content and data services supplier, to actually say to clients, you know, I will help you create more data because you have already exploited everything that you had, you know, at reach, immediately at reach. But I can help you convert all these assets into data so that you finally have more data. So I think that the reason why I disagree is because, yes, I agree, if we look at data that is available immediately, it's a bit like oil. Sometimes people say there is no more oil because it's the oil at the surface. But if you dig deeper, there is more oil. You have to make an effort.
I love that analogy, Bruno. I'm going to use it.
Feel free. I think there is a real business opportunity, not just for the content and data services company, but I would say for even a small translation agency that I would like now to be transformed into something new for the clients. Because then, you know, it's just one service. It's conversion of assets into data. But there is so much to do. And okay, I have no time now to explain that, but there is so much to do that there is a real opportunity to, you know, to say, yes, data has been used and overused, but there is more data that can be created other than synthetic data, of course, by looking at all these. I'm just curious. I would like to get data about, you know, even in multinationals, the millions of files that are stored on the cloud, the millions of files that have been created by marketing, by product management, by communications. All these files are there and it's content, but it needs to be converted from crude oil to gas.
Yeah. No, I know. And you know what? It's all about datafication. We've talked about datafication for many years. Mm-hmm. And it's about converting all these static files into some active databases. And my background is in the database industry. And I've worked on DB2 when DB2 was still a thought in IBM, I guess, at the point on the mainframe. So here you are. Now we're talking about data. So we're converting everything to data, which is the solution. And it's such a, you know, it's like somebody saying, you know, I want to make whatever widget you want to make, but I need raw material. Your raw material is the data. You can do whatever you want to do out of that. Sorry, we're coming up to an end here. I just want to make sure that we give you a few moments for the last comments, I guess. I'll start with Cynthia, your first time on the podcast. How do you feel between having a conversation between Bruno, myself, and yourself? What do you think?
Always good to chat with both of you. Like I said, when we met, it was such a pleasure. We had such a natural conversation at the airport and throughout our time in Saudi Arabia. So thank you so much for having me.
And I appreciate you being with us, and I hope you can take some time and come back again. You're welcome to be back anytime you want to. This channel is your channel.
Thank you so
Bruno,
much.
Any thought on your side?
Well, Robin, it was enjoyable to chat with you last year. It's even more enjoyable to chat with Cynthia and you today. So
absolutely,
that we have this opportunity. And I think it was a great continuation from our discussion in Riyadh and in the beautiful lounge of Lufthansa.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. It was, it's always great to share opinions and, you know, to hear or to listen to what other people are doing. So thanks for making this happen, Robin.
I appreciate it. I appreciate your time. Cynthia, Bruno, thanks so much for our audience. I thank you so much for joining me today. Thanks for listening in if you're coming in on our podcast. And thanks for reading the blog. I'm noticing a lot of people are reading the blog because it's easier way to capture the summary of the conversation. You can catch our blog on robinayoub.blog. If you want to check it out, you can see previous episodes all summarized on the blog site. And also thanks for you if you're joining us on YouTube. I appreciate it if you can like, subscribe, or share, or comment, whatever you prefer. Thanks for our audience for supporting us. We're approaching 500,000 views in less than a year and a half. On a very niche channel with a, you know, it's just something I do as a personal favor to the industry, I think. And nobody's paying me to do this. And I enjoy doing it. And I take pleasure in speaking to our guests today and future guests in the future and the past guests that we've had on this channel, up to 94 guests on the channel in a year and a half. So thanks so much for everybody for listening in. Thanks for our beautiful guests that they joined me today. And I look forward to future conversation. For our guest, don't leave after we stop recording. the videos still need to upload. Thanks so much for everybody.